Can you please name all the different fields that you work in?
Well, I'm a professor in material science and engineering. So most of what we do has some kind of core, novelty on the materials aspect of things. But in many cases, we want to understand the materials, but also to apply them to devices and systems. So it really, spans all the way from, basic material science, which involves, chemistry and synthesis and processing, to incorporation of those materials into devices, which gets more into electrical engineering and mechanical engineering. So it's really that core in material science, but it spreads out to many fields of technology and engineering.
Okay. What technology are you currently working on?
Well, a few things. One is that we're interested in classes of electronic devices that you can't build very easily with conventional silicon wafer-based approaches, which is by far the dominant, technology that's used in electronics, whether it's, in your laptop computer or in your cell phone display or your wristwatch. We're interested in other kinds of materials, polymers and plastics that would allow you to build electronic devices that, behave like silicon devices in at the circuit level, but enable a sort of form factors, mechanical characteristics, weights, and things like that that can't be achieved with relatively heavy, brittle, inorganic materials like silicon and glass. So we're interested in like large area, mechanically flexible circuits for wall scale displays or roll up electronic newspaper type systems. So really, trying to bring new classes of materials into electronics, not to compete directly with silicon, but to enable new kinds of devices, that you can't achieve with wafer based systems.
So the polymers are almost better than the silicon?
Well, in some ways. So we're not hoping really, it's not probably realistic for us to think that the polymer materials would be able to build a faster Pentium chip, for example, but it would be able to build a very lightweight, mechanically flexible display that would look like, conventional ink on paper, but would behave like a liquid crystal display in the sense that you could watch movies on it, you could bring up, text for books and things of that nature. So really trying to move electronics into different kinds of form factors, different mechanical characteristics than those that you can achieve with silicon. And the materials are key to enabling those kinds of systems because silicon and glass are intrinsically heavy and brittle, fragile, and so they're inherently ill-suited for those kind of applications.
Mm-hmm. So you're engineering all of this. What is it like being an engineer?
Well, I'm here at a university. I spent, several years at Bell Laboratories and have been involved in startup companies. So engineering can exist, both at the fundamental kind of very researchy level, which is, the dominant kind of activity that would go on at a university, all the way to product design and development and prototyping and things like that, which is typically best accomplished in kind of a company environment. So engineering as a discipline is interesting for that reason, because it does span this very wide range of very basic fundamental stuff can go on as part of engineering research. But usually there's an eye toward possible end applications, which is to say that the research is geared such that if you understand the underlying science, there's the potential for that enabling, new kinds of devices and applications and so on. And so that's what I like about engineering, is because it really, combines those two aspects. It's not just fundamental research in a complete vacuum. It's really, that kind of work with an eye toward end applications that could, have an impact on society and make people's lives better.
Okay. So when did you first start to get into this engineering?
Well, I think probably when I was in elementary school, we had a science fair competition, and that was the first time that I really began to get interested in things like that, because unlike, classroom activities, that the science fair enabled you to think on your own, design a project, do something, carry out the experiments. And I think my dad was a big influence on me. As an elementary student, you're not really configured to do a real experiment. But with some guidance from my father, I think, we were able to do some interesting things and place well in those competitions. And so there was sort of a competitive aspect of it, certainly, but it really sort of opened my eyes to you know, science as it exists in the real world, which is, you know, not in a classroom type mm-hmm. environment where, you know, problems are specifically tailored to have well-defined solutions and everything is kind of laid out for you. Sort of, you know, it's more free-form exploratory activity is what, you know, attracted me to science and engineering. I think the first exposure I got to it was in those science fair competitions.
So did your dad have a lot to do with science and engineering?
Yeah, he had a PhD in physics and worked in a research lab for Texaco. So it's sort of geology and physics and seismology of that type. And so he had a very, very strong background in physics.
So did anybody else in your family help influence your work?
Not so much. My mother is a poet, and the kinds of things that she likes to write about are sort of the science of nature and the world around us. So I think her influence is there as well. Probably my father's a little bit more strongly in the sense of sort of a concrete guiding, you know, toward these, you know, topics of work and research.
Okay. So after elementary school, did you just continue to go more into the sciences?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't, you know, I wasn't sort of obsessively focused on it. You know, that wouldn't, you know, accurately characterize what was going on. But certainly is very, very interested, you know, took all the advanced courses and, you know, continued in science fair competitions through high school. And, you know, in addition to the science fairs, I think they have it in Illinois as well. In Texas, where I grew up, there was a very active community of, you know, science magnet schools and other places that would host sort of science and math, you know, exam type competitions on weekends and things like that. And so, you know, each school would have their team, you know, and you would go and you could compete with other schools. And so that sort of stimulated, you know, additional, you know, study and focus and enjoyment of science.
Okay. So you had a very broad, well, science is very broad. So, how did you come down into material science?
Yeah, I think, materials, sort of new materials, if you look around, it usually, you know, materials innovations is what oftentimes drives all kinds of other innovations in other engineering disciplines. And so sometimes people will say if there were no materials engineering, there would be no engineering. You know, it's just core to everything. Everything is made out of material, right? So I think that forms a good launching point, and it allows you to get into all other kinds of forms of engineering, mechanical, electrical, you know, chemical. And so I think it's the sort of centrality and the core importance of materials that drew me to that particular discipline. But, you know, ultimately I like to build widgets, you know, and like to, you know, make devices of some type. And, you know, having the ability to innovate at the materials level opens up all kinds of possibilities for new classes of devices. And I think these flexible electronic systems are a good example of that.
Mm-hmm. Could you describe your college experience after high school?
Yeah, I was an undergraduate at University of Texas at Austin. I grew up in Houston. And so it was a gigantic state school, very similar to University of Illinois, you know, fairly highly ranked school, but certainly a very diverse, you know, student body and, you know, very, very large classes and, you know, all kinds of subjects were offered and so on. And so I like that kind of environment, and I like being back in that kind of environment here at University of Illinois. I had a scholarship to study chemistry, but I was also interested in, you know, more hardcore physics of how those, you know, how the chemistry works, you know, the underlying quantum mechanics and so on. So I did a dual major in chemistry and in physics and got two bachelor's degrees, mainly focused on coursework. I didn't have a chance because I was doing those dual majors to do a lot of research while I was an undergraduate. And, you know, a lot of people do have a chance to do that if, you know, they're faced with a slightly less demanding course load. But that's kind of the path that I chose. I don't think it really, you know, set me back at all. But it was really, you know, my undergraduate experience is very much focused on the courses and establishing sort of a baseline of knowledge in these two important areas, which, you know, are, you know, critical kind of knowledge for materials research.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any influential professors?
That's a good question. I remember some of my high school teachers, but I think by the time I went to college, I more or less had a sense of what I wanted to do. And so I certainly had very good professors, but I don't think at that stage in my thinking, there was any one professor that was, super influential, because I was sort of on a track that I sort of knew I wanted to pursue at that point. And so there was, no real need or opportunity for an advisor, to provide additional guidance on top of that.
Okay. So you said that some of your high school teachers were influential. How did they influence you?
Just getting me interested and excited about science. I had a very, very good biology teacher, Mr. Steinkamp, and Mrs. Mariotti taught chemistry. And I remember those two in particular, just because they knew the subject so well and were really passionate about, teaching the students, so that they could understand and appreciate those subjects in the way that they did. And so I do remember that.
Okay. So did you go to, you went to MIT, right?
For graduate school, yeah.
Okay. So what did you mainly do there?
Well, I studied physical chemistry, which is, in some ways closely related to material science. I mean, it's a separate discipline, but really, combines chemistry and physics. So it sort of played pretty strongly to my own interests in research. And so that's what I obtained my PhD in. While I was there, I also picked up master's degrees in physics and chemistry, which is mainly additional coursework, on top of the undergraduate work that I'd already done. We were working at that time on experiments that involve very, very short pulsed lasers. So lasers that turn on and off in very short timescales. Pulses that are so short in time duration that they're shorter than the characteristic time that's required for two molecules to react with one another. And so in those days, those kind of lasers were brand new. And what they basically provided, at some level, is a very sophisticated strobe light for stopping the action of a chemical reaction. So you can actually watch how these molecules react with one another in real time by using these specialized lasers. And somehow that really appealed to me, because it was sophisticated technology in terms of the lasers and how to do the experiments, but it allowed you to directly view in real time the fundamental mechanisms by which chemical species react with one another to generate new compounds. And I think at that time, it continues to be the case to some extent, but there's tremendous level of excitement in that field. Some of the developments that occurred in ultra-fast lasers immediately applied to these chemistry problems. And in fact, a few years after I was a graduate student, a Nobel Prize was awarded to Ahmed Zewail, who's at Caltech, who's doing very, very similar kinds of experiments, which just kind of illustrate the level of excitement that surrounded that field and the kind of insights you could gain into chemical reaction dynamics by doing those sorts of experiments.
Mm-hmm. So these lasers seemed very interesting to you. What was getting your PhD like?
Well, it's a lot different than being an undergraduate or a high school student, because more like the science fair type activity, in the sense it was completely open-ended. There's no schedule. You had to come in each day and figure out what you're going to do, prioritize your activities, solve problems on your own, understand how to take a project from a concept through a set of experiments to investigate a phenomena to reach some kind of conclusion, and then write it up in a paper that's published in a journal. So all of those things were completely new for me. And so the first year or two, you're really trying to find your footing and understand how science is done. But I think the experience is tremendously valuable, even for people who don't continue on in science. That PhD program and the kind of learning that occurs during that process is just extremely important for all kinds of you know, careers, even those outside of research and science. So it was a lot of long nights and, you know, struggling with the equipment, trying to make the lasers work. And as soon as you get them to work, you try to frantically do your experiments before they stop working again, because, you know, it's very much, you know, bleeding edge technology, and everything's right on the hairy edge of not working. And so it could be frustrating at times, but it was very rewarding when the experiments would work out and you would get a clean set of data and you could, you know, say something new about the way nature was operating, you know, in terms of the chemistry and how things were reacting.
Were there other obstacles that you had to overcome?
Yeah, I guess obstacles. I think the science was pretty straightforward. But again, I think just learning how to cope with uncertainty and open-endedness in projects and so on was something that was challenging for me. I think probably most graduate students experience that and would have similar comments. I don't think I'm really unique in that sense. But, you know, those first couple of years trying to figure out, you know, how to do this, you know, this PhD type of research. And so it's frustrating, pretty challenging. But then once you sort of understand how to go about, you know, pursuing a project and how to, you know, prioritize your different activities, then it gets to be really fun, because you develop a proficiency at the experiments and can really ask, you know, questions yourself, and then, you know, understand how to pursue those answers and collect the data to understand what's going on.
What support did you get while you were receiving your PhD?
Well, I was I had a National Science Foundation fellowship, so it provided a stipend, basically just, you know, enough money to live on. You know, it was much, much less than you would make if you had a regular job, you know, with a bachelor's degree type of experience. But it was enough for me. I lived in dorm rooms on campus the entire time I was there, and the rents were heavily subsidized. So even the fellowship, you know, was a relatively modest amount of money. It was, you know, plenty to live comfortably. And during those days, your life is really focused on the lab. And so there wasn't a lot of free time or a lot of need to have, you know, a lot of disposable income to do different things, because you're really, you know, focused on what was going on in the lab and working with your colleagues and collaborating and so on.
So after MIT, you moved on to Harvard. And so why did you make that whole transition?
Well, you know, at some point you graduate, you get your doctorate, you complete the PhD program. And at that stage, most people, you know, are faced with a choice. They either can, you know, go get a job in science or engineering, either, you know, at an industrial type of environment, a startup type of environment, or, you know, go to university and become a professor. Or what's more typical, if, you know, what you want to pursue that university path, or if you want a very top job in, you know, in a famous research institute, then you will typically go from your PhD to what's called a postdoctoral type of position, which is more or less a follow-on, you know, just continuing the kind of research activity that you pursued as a PhD. But usually you go and work in a completely different field. And instead of the 4, 5, or 6 years that's typical for, you know, getting a PhD, a postdoctoral position will typically last only 2 years. And one of the reasons, I think, you know, well, there's sort of a couple of reasons why that system exists. One is that I think it's a great opportunity, and I really enjoyed it, for a person to go and quickly, in a pretty, you know, compressed time frame, this 2 years, obtain expertise or deep knowledge about a completely new field of study or scientific research that's different from what they learned in their PhD. So it really gives you an opportunity to broaden your range of expertise and understand a new field. The other thing was, it's more sort of more of a practical concern, is I think when employers at top places like, you know, IBM Research or Bell Labs Research or at a university, when they're sizing up candidates and applicants for those positions, it's reassuring for them to see that somebody did well not only in their PhD, but also in their postdoctoral research, because it's completely different fields. And sometimes you can stumble into a lucky situation, you know, in your PhD work, and there could be, you know, a working project there that's hot, and you just sort of mine it out. And by forcing people to go into a different field and try to repeat that level of success in this postdoctoral position, it allows people to better size up, you know, the one's sort of aptitude for doing research. And so when I was at Harvard, it was a little bit different than the ordinary postdoctoral position. So I looked around at various places. Harvard was attractive to me for because there was a particular person there, and also because I had won a fellowship there, which gave me membership in something called the Society of Fellows. And so they have seven postdoctoral positions that they give out every year in all fields of academic study, not just science, but also, you know, literature and history and other areas. And it's sort of has a level of prestige that's quite a bit higher than a conventional postdoctoral position. And it also gives you membership in this society, which while you were there, gave you the opportunity to go to dinners twice a week and lunches mm-hmm. three times a week with the other junior fellows who had these postdoctoral positions, as well as select faculty at Harvard who were senior fellows of the society. So it gave you a chance to interact with very, very smart people and just, you know, learn about other fields of research and academic study.
So what was it like on this process to become a junior fellow?
Well, it's sort of a... it's sort of a secret society at some level. I mean, they don't advertise widely for the position. It's typically the type of thing where, you know, if you don't know it exists, they don't want you applying anyway. You know, so it's not that they turn away applicants, but it's really sort of application by invitation only, almost like that. And my advisor at PhD advisor at MIT knew someone else at MIT who had previously been a junior fellow, and he suggested that, you know, maybe I would want to apply for that position. And yeah, I did. I just put my application in the hat and was lucky enough that it was pulled out. You know, sort of had the opportunity to take that.
You said that that person, he was a junior fellow. So are you still a junior fellow?
That's a good question. I don't know if I'd be officially called a junior fellow or just a fellow. There's like junior fellow, I think, applies to you when you are at Harvard in that position. And then after you've finished your stay there, you retain membership in the society, but I don't think you're called junior fellow anymore. You've moved on. You're not senior fellow because you're not faculty at Harvard and part of the society. So something in between, but I'm not sure what the exact name is. But when I mentioned that they were a junior fellow, it means that they were in the position that I was in and then subsequently came to MIT as a member of the faculty and, you know, set up their research group, whatever.
Uh-huh. So then after you were at Harvard, you started this Active Impulse Systems.
Yeah.
What motivated or inspired you to launch?
Well, that was launched simultaneous with my position at Harvard. One of the good things about being in the society is they don't have any requirements on you. It's basically a funded position to do whatever you want, literally. And so there was an example, just one case to give you a sense. Somebody who was granted this position, who did his PhD research in theoretical physics, and then decided while he was a junior fellow at Harvard to make a full-time study of the Chinese chess equivalent game called Go. And so he just did that. I mean, that's all he did. And so that was a nice thing about that position. It gave you a tremendous amount of flexibility. So although while I was at Harvard, I was formally attached to a lab of George Whitesides, who's in the chemistry department. So I was doing experiments there and collaborating with people and publishing and so on. But about half my time I was spending on a startup company that we launched that came out of some of the research that I was doing during my PhD work at MIT. So we launched that. It was a company that was exploiting some laser-based techniques that we developed to measure the properties of thin film materials as used in silicon microelectronics. So it's a, you know, the end result of that is a tool about the size of a washing machine that involves lasers and optics and high-speed detectors and, you know, software algorithms to interpret the data that basically would shine light on a silicon wafer and measure important properties of the films that are deposited on top of it. And those kind of tools go in a clean room manufacturing facility that Intel might run, for example, to do some kind of real-time metrology and process control on, you know, how the wafers are being, you know, how materials are being deposited on the wafers and how they're moving through the process. So,
Were there any particular stories that, well, like while you're starting Active Impulse Systems?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was sort of, you know, it's a sort of probably a standard kind of a startup thing. I mean, we The way that it got started is that they at MIT every year they have a business plan competition. So a lot of the students in the engineering school are very sort of entrepreneurial in their mindset, and so they offer that they have this competition every year, which involves teaming of students from the engineering side of MIT with people in the business school at MIT called the Sloan School to basically build a marketing and business development plan around some idea that the engineers have come up with for a new product or a new piece of software, for example. And we decided to enter that because the last year that I was in at MIT had pretty much finished my thesis research and had some, was still doing experiments, but had some time to, you know, do some other things. And we formed a team to do that business plan competition, and it was based on this idea that we had for these laser type measurements, and teamed up with a couple of people in the business school and wrote a business plan and made it all the way to the finals. I mean, this is like a very, very competitive competition that they have, because like everyone wants to win it. And, you know, at the time that I was there, it was a $10,000 prize, you know, if you came in first, which I think is like $100,000 now. So this is back in 95, mm-hmm. but, you know, 10K was a lot of money then. And so we made it to the final. There's like 200 entries or something on that order. And, we made it to the final four. We didn't win, but we were selected as finalists, and as part of that competition, the judges are actually venture capitalists in the Boston area. So these are basically bankers who have money to invest in new company ideas to get them off the ground, and with the hopes that, you know, if that company becomes successful, then their initial investment in it can become, you know, very, very valuable. So there were a number of venture capitalists who were on the judging panel for this thing. And even though we didn't win, there were a number of them who liked our idea a lot. Mm-hmm. And so they provided some seed capital for getting the company started, hire employees and get office space and, do a lot of the investments that's required to do the, you know, engineering of the tool. And so that's kind of how we got started. And we ended up having a manufacturing facility in Natick, Massachusetts, a little bit outside of Boston. And so... So it was fun, you know, that grew. I guess we started it in 95, and by 1998, we had, you know, a good stream of sales. We had a tool that worked, and people in the industry liked it, and we were acquired by Philips Electronics, the Dutch company, in August of 1998. They basically bought the whole thing out, and mm-hmm. some of the employees stayed, and Philips still makes that tool. And so it was fun. It was a pretty cool experience.
So you're saying we. So you had a little group. Do you know if some of those people in your group are still...
Oh, yeah, stay in touch with them. I mean, the core founders, it was myself, a guy who was in the same research group that I was at MIT but had graduated 2 years before me and actually, became a patent attorney. And so he was interested in leaving the law firm that he was with. He didn't really like that environment. And so he teamed up with us and my advisor. Those were the core founders. And then we brought on a CEO who had a sort of a co-founding status as well. But the patent attorney turned out to be tremendously valuable, because when you're a small company at that stage, really all you own are ideas. I mean, you don't have a product, you don't have sales. And so his sort of ability to write patent applications around some of the ideas that we were coming up with in those days was tremendously valuable. And so he is now in San Diego, started up a new company on personal health monitors. So rings that you put around your finger that can measure your blood pressure and your pulse rate and your blood oxygen content with a wireless transmitter that transmits that information to the internet and can be downloaded by your doctor. So still technology, completely different than the laser-based stuff, but, you know, very, very, you know, our entrepreneurial type of stuff.
Are you still in charge of the active impulse systems?
No. I have a consulting role, but that's pretty much it. At this point, you know, the technology gets better every year. So, I understand how the machines work, but at this point, I'm not even that valuable. I mean, the kind of employees that they have there, and, you know, their complete focus on that tool and making it better really outstrips anything that we can do here in a university lab. And so they're completely independent, and they do, you know, great stuff and publish papers and sell tools. So I, you know, familiar with it, and I see them maybe once a year, but that's the extent of it.
What About what time did you transition from being in charge of the Active Impulse Systems?
Oh, probably when I finished up my position as junior fellow and went to Bell Labs. At that point, the company had really established momentum. And in the early days, I was writing all the software and tweaking the lasers and thinking about, you know, the optical designs and modeling that and helping with measurements and so on. But, you know, as time goes on, you get employees, they're there, you know, full time and begin to develop a deep understanding of how the tool works. So I think your involvement is very high the first year, 2 years, and begins to, you know, taper off, with the exception of certain firefighting activities. Something unexpected happens, you know, you need to take a look at it. But by the time it was sold to Philips, I wasn't, you know, that crucial to the continued operation of the company. So I stayed involved, but not on a day-to-day basis.
So for those of us who don't know, what is Bell Labs?
Bell Labs is the research and development arm of Lucent Technologies. So when I went there in 1997, Lucent was a fairly sizable company. It was the sort of the product part of AT&T. So they underwent a trivestiture, sort of a splitting off of different business units. I believe that was in 1996, and Lucent Technologies was the core, you know, technology piece of what was formerly AT&T. So it was the part of the company that did the signal processing electronics for telecommunications, built the lasers, did the optical fiber, did the software control of switching and so on. And all of that was embedded in Lucent Technologies, and Bell Labs was the research component of that company.
Okay. What events brought you from Bell Labs to the University of Illinois?
Well, a few things, I guess. One was I had been at Bell Labs for about 5 years by the time I had left. And if you look at the history of the labs, the median time for someone to be at Bell Labs before moving on is about 6 years. Mm-hmm. So I think I had reached the point at which I was ready to make a change. And so that was part of it. The other part of it is that in 2000, 2001, the bottom dropped out of the telecommunications market as part of the technology crash, and that did tremendous damage to Lucent as a company. You know, all our sales dried up, and there was a lot of downsizing at the company. It went from about 130,000 employees worldwide at its peak when I was there to about 30,000 today. So it was absolutely a different company now than it was when I first joined. And you know, size matters, especially in a research environment, because you need to have critical mass and all the core expertise in order to do your work efficiently. And that began to shrink down in a way that made it a little bit less exciting place, you know, for me to be. It was still great, but not as great as it was when I first went there. So that was part of the thinking as well. And then the other and probably the most important thing is my wife and I had a baby and in September 2002, and she at the time was working at a spin-out from Bell Labs. We were both working there for a couple of years, but then she went with a spin-out of Lucent in optical data storage in Colorado. And with the birth of the baby, we just decided we got to, you know, do something to solve the geography issue. And partly because her parents live in Chicago, partly because the University of Illinois is just a fantastically good engineering and science school, we thought this would be a good place to come. So,
okay. Could you describe, in your opinion, the recent remarkable growth of technology at the university here? And why is Champaign-Urbana a top tech city?
Well, it's just driven by the university. I think that's the simple answer. The corollary to that is, why is the university here and not someplace else? And that, I think, goes back to sort of the land grant, you know, situation and so on. But I think, I don't know, I think the history of the place is a lot of the reason why it can maintain, a leadership role in terms of, research at universities. It has a breadth and a size in its engineering and science areas that's really unmatched, I think, sort of quality breadth and size sort of taken together. I think even at a place like MIT, the quality is very, very high, but it doesn't quite have the breadth or the number of people. And so it's really those attributes which attracted me to Illinois, because my research is highly collaborative in nature. And so the bigger the departments, say, you know, electrical engineering, I'm interested in some research there, the better it is for me, because the more likely the chances are that I'll be able to find someone of like mind in those fields to work together with. And so that size and quality and breadth are what attracted me here. And it probably sort of an avalanche effect. I mean, once you have that, then you just keep attracting top talent, and it sort of self-perpetuates, you know. And so my guess is it's that. I think also, given where we are geographically, it's a cost-effective place to do research, in the sense that the cost of living is low, the university is configured such that the overhead rates are low, the infrastructure is extremely good in terms of general user facilities and instrumentation and so on. So it's a very good place to just get work done and do research. And so for people who are very focused on their work, I think it's difficult to imagine a better place.
What were some of your main discoveries?
Since coming here?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe two. One is we've been interested in this flexible electronics. And so, you know, putting electronic circuits on a piece of paper, for example, and like I mentioned before, making a display that looks and feels like, you know, paper rather than mm-hmm. a heavy, you know, glass plate like a liquid crystal display. And so bendability is one kind of mechanical characteristic that you could think about. So if you look at a sheet of paper, you can bend it, but you mm-hmm. can't stretch it. So if you try to pull it like this, nobody's going to be able to see
yeah.
this, but you get the idea. You try to pull it, it's stiff. But you can bend it very easily. And really the reason why you can bend it is that it's thin. You can't mm-hmm. bend a 2x4. It's made out of the same material
yeah.
as the paper. But it's really by virtue of the fact that the paper is thin that it's bendable. So it turns out that if you make silicon very, very thin, so
mm-hmm.
instead of, you know, the thickness of a silicon wafer, you make your silicon, you know, 1/100th the thickness of a human hair, suddenly you can bend silicon as well. And so there are pathways then to make silicon the foundation of these kind of flexible electronic devices that I've been talking about. And that's one thing that we've been pursuing. And so bendable silicon can be done. But maybe more interestingly, we found recently that you can make silicon not only bendable, again, straightforward way to do that, just make the silicon thin, and that's what we do. But you can also make the silicon stretchable. And so before I tell you how to make you can make silicon stretchable, you might wonder, why would I want to have silicon stretchable?
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, bendable is nice for a display. You might want to roll it up or fold it up when you're not using it. But bendable is okay. But if you want, say, a wearable electronic device, bendable is not that great, because you know wearing a garbage sack just isn't comfortable, or wearing a sheet of paper isn't comfortable because it doesn't stretch. And so if you'd want, say, a personal health monitor, you know, electronics built into your clothing, just as an example, you'd want something more than bendable electronics. You'd want stretchable electronics, so it could sort of form to the contours of your body and stretch mm-hmm. and move with you, like spandex, for example. And so we discovered just by chance, really, that you can make silicon stretchable. And the way that you make it stretchable is you can form it using well-controlled mechanical buckling techniques into periodic wavy shapes. So you take very thin silicon and you buckle it into a sinusoidal kind of wave-like geometry. And once it's in that geometry, then it becomes like an accordion bellows, in the sense that you can stretch it back and forth reversibly without inducing a lot of strains in the silicon itself, which would lead to cracking. So the amplitudes and wavelengths of those waves just change in order to accommodate the strains that you're applying. So you can make silicon completely stretchable. In fact, you can build silicon electronic devices on a rubber band and, you know, stretch it back and forth like that.
Uh-huh.
So we think these kind of simple kind of, you know, materials, mechanical engineering approaches can allow you to achieve any kind of mechanical characteristic you want, even out of a very brittle, fragile material like silicon. And so that turned out to be something that I think will, you know, in the long term turn out to be something neat, you know, and maybe have some application value.
Okay, so what do you think that this paper, like silicon, will accomplish?
Well, like if you want, for example, you know, health monitoring circuits built into your, you know, your pants or your shirt to basically monitor your well-being and your health and the, you know, the status of your body, that could be an interesting thing. There are other applications that we've been funded by the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency to pursue. And those include things like large, flexible, bendable sheets of sensors and electronics that you can wrap around an aircraft wing or an aircraft hull to provide sort of real-time information on the stresses and the strains and the airflow patterns and crack formation in the structural materials of the airplane to basically make sure that it's operating as it should be and just increase the safety of flight. And also maybe at another level, be able to provide some real-time information to a central flight computer to control the flight parameters, you know, in real time as the plane is flying.
Mm-hmm. So in the future, we could actually wear our electronics.
Yeah, that would be the idea. You know, I'm not sure exactly when that's coming, but I think we have shown that you can really put high quality on electronics on any kind of surface. I mean, further out into the future, you could imagine actually forming circuits on the threads that form your clothing. I mean, that's sort of way into the future, mm-hmm. but this is the kind of vision that we have, is just being able to put electronics on anything such that it's more useful to the consumer, the operator of the device. I mean, silicon's great for lots of things, but it's always in the form of hard, brittle chips, and you don't want to wear a plate mail, of silicon chips. It just doesn't work well.
How do you come across your inventions? Do you just serendipitously come about them?
Well, in this case, I think a lot of science has to do with just carefully observing what happens in your experiments. I mean, in many cases, you'll have a great idea and you'll see how a certain system will play out, and then you go in the lab and you do it and it works out that way. It turns out to be rarely the case. Usually you can't anticipate all the effects that are going to happen before you actually do the experiment. That's why you do the experiment. And so a lot of times the key to being a good scientist, and I think of an innovative researcher, is being able to look very carefully at the outcomes of your experiments to see what nature is telling you. And so in this case of wavy, stretchable silicon, it really was something that we stumbled upon purely by accident. So we were making these thin silicon wires that we would put on flexible sheet of plastic to make these bendable circuits. Okay, so it wasn't stretchable. But the way that we were transferring those wires to the place where we grew them onto the flexible plastic substrate where we were building our devices relied on basically a rubber stamp to pick them up and print them. And what we noticed is that one time one of my students was doing this, he accidentally stretched a little bit the rubber stamp before he contacted it with the silicon wires. And so he contacted it with the silicon wires in this pre-stretched state and then lifted back the stamp and simultaneously relaxed this pre-strain. And what happened is that the wires, which were bonded to the surface of that stamp in that stretched state, were forced to undergo this buckling transformation in order to accommodate the compressive strains associated with the stamp snapping back to its original shape. And we just happened to notice that under a microscope, that these things made these beautiful wave-like structures. And then we just decided that would offer this kind of, or we realized that it would offer this kind of stretchability. And then we just, begin to engineer it to a level of control that we could do things in a systematic way. And then we collaborated with people in the mechanical engineering to do all of the theory of how these things respond to stresses. And so in that case, it was purely an accident, but not completely an accident. I mean, it was an accident that many people would have overlooked. And I think that's really the key is, in science, it requires very, very careful observation about, what the experiments are telling you.
Okay. So do you have any stories about how you came about these inventions?
Well, in addition to that one, I don't. Let me think about that a little bit more. I mean, there's probably a story behind just about everything that we do. Let me think about that some more.
Okay. What do you research?
We research materials, these kind of electronic systems. We also work in new techniques for patterning circuits and devices out of these materials. So approach is based on stamping and molding, kind of very conceptually old ways to manipulate materials, but using new materials to allow that kind of manipulation at levels of fidelity and registration and resolution that are, you know, far beyond anything that anybody has done in the past. So we do a lot of different things. I mean, the group that I run is fairly large. It's maybe 30 students or so. About half of them are graduate students. Half of them are postdocs. So we have research activities in very wide-ranging, you know, subject areas. But, again, primarily things that have, you know, novel materials at the core.
Is being diligent a large part of your job, just always researching a lot?
Yeah, you have to be careful. I mean, I think, you know, not only being observant, but really asking questions about the results that you might see that might not be compatible with your initial thought about what's going on, but may be more reflective about what's actually going on. So really thinking about all of the different possible explanations that could account for a particular observation, and then doing additional experiments, sort of this diligence aspect, to rule out, you know, those different explanations, to isolate the one that's most likely, you know, the correct one. But, you know, science is always kind of self-correcting, and, you know, you be as careful as you can when you're doing experiments and interpreting them. But, you know, science is a very dynamic thing. And so, you know, explanations for phenomena are constantly being revised. And so I think staying focused on a problem and seeing it through to a convincing and correct explanation of the underlying phenomena, and then, you know, using that to, you know, benefit new devices and application possibilities, I think is a big part of it.
What is your latest invention, and how did it come about?
Well, I think the stretchable silicon is the latest stuff that we're doing. We formed a company and flexible silicon. So we formed a startup company over the summer to try to commercialize some of this stuff. So we're really at this point focused on taking it from, you know, research paper style demonstrations of capabilities to a level of manufacturing reproducibility that will allow us to do things on a realistic scale. And I think the initial applications will be in sort of conventional areas of electronics, but using our approaches and materials to lower the cost and enable much higher performance targets. So we have joint efforts with large companies that make displays for laptop screens, for example, to try to develop these things more fully. But, you know, on our roadmap of application possibilities, we really have our eyes on some of the more exciting things like flexible displays and stretchable electronics a few years from now.
Do you recall a particularly challenging moment when you were working on the silicon, the paper silicon?
Yeah, I think understanding exactly the underlying mechanics of how these things behave under strains and stresses is turned out to be a surprisingly subtle and non-trivial problem. So I think experimentally we understand the system very well, but we're still kind of struggling with a basic theoretical understanding of what's going on. So there can be frustrations there, but, you know, it's the type of thing that, you know, you can envision, in the future, near future, we'll have that worked out. And I think it'll be, you know, very, very satisfying to have everything, you know, understood at, you know, that very fundamental level.
So some of your inventions and discoveries, they're just kind of trying to figure out explanations?
Sometimes I think a lot of what we do, you know, is fundamental in that sense, trying to explain how nature behaves. But most of the scientific problems that we choose are ones whose solution can enable some kind of application that we have in mind. So it's applications driven, not exclusively, but usually we have some target, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years out or whatever, but some notion of a direction that we're going. Without, of course, you know, eliminating sort of the ability to be opportunistic and follow, you know, what unexpected discoveries come out of the lab. But a lot of it is explanation based, but a lot of it is sort of process and techniques and new device configurations. And a lot of those things we capture through patents that we file through the university, the Office of Technology Management here. So if we have a good idea, usually we'll file a patent on that, and then that piece of intellectual property becomes something that could be licensed by an outside company, or it could be licensed by our startup company. to try to, you know, exploit it to make new things. And you know.
Can you tell us more about your research and your research group?
Well, the group is, you know, very, very diverse group. As I mentioned, it's about 30 students, about 15 PhD students. They come from a lot of different departments, mostly material science, but I have students from chemistry and physics and electrical engineering as well, mechanical engineering. And so they work on all different kinds of problems. The group itself has a lot of expertise embedded in it. And so not only, you know, does the group consist of people doing research, but the group itself becomes a resource for the members in the group in terms of, you know, facilitating their work. So it's highly collaborative within the group, outside of the group with people in other departments and, you know, focused on these kind of, you know, engineering outcomes.
How has this research and development process affected you and your own research?
Well, usually it's interesting that there's what I've found to be the case, whether it's with a startup company or, you know, back at Bell Labs, where a lot of the research was pretty closely tied to product development, is that having a close tie-in to engineering and devices and commercialization actually makes your scientific research better because it helps you identify what are the key problems, what are the most important unanswered questions in terms of, you know, making something real. And that engineering development oftentimes leads to techniques and measurement capabilities that wouldn't ordinarily be possible or be developed by the scientific enterprise. And so the outcomes of the engineering effort can fold back into the science in a way that makes the science better. And then the better science can enable new applications. And so it's kind of an interesting positive feedback loop that happens between those two kinds of efforts. And so it's something that I've always found to be valuable to sort of embed explicitly into your research operation, this, you know, close tie to engineering and startup companies, large companies and things like that.
What techniques do you use in your research?
Well, a lot of it is like clean room type processing. So the kinds of tools and processing approaches that are used for silicon device manufacture, the kinds of approaches that we use to build our structures or manipulate our materials. But then, of course, it goes way beyond that because it involves, you know, basic chemical synthesis, and test tubes and beakers. And a lot of analytical equipment and instrumentation, very high-powered microscopes to look at the structures that we've built, specialized kinds of tools that can tell you the chemical composition of the materials, both at the surface and through the bulk, different kinds of optical methods for probing the way that light flows through the materials in order to gain some insights into their basic makeup. So sort of clean room processing at the core, but then all of the other kinds of you know, scientific instruments that are used for physical science, we're at our disposal as well.
What driving force keeps you motivated to research new technologies?
I think just coming up with new things and trying to enable new capabilities. I think, you know, sort of science at the core, but, you know, this engineering part is attractive to me as well. I can't remember who said it, but there was an interesting quote, which is something that along the lines of scientists tell you how nature works in its existing form, and engineers create a world that never existed before. And so, you know, doing both of those kind of things is very, very satisfying. You know, identifying some new scientific phenomena and then exploiting it, you know, to do some kind of engineering, create something that didn't exist before.
Could you describe what you thought your research and your inventions would accomplish before they were used?
Well, I think it's hard to know exactly, you know, what the end outcome. You sort of have a vague idea of where these things might go, but you never know quite what's going to happen. I mean, just give you an example. You know, we were working on these laser-based techniques to study chemical reaction dynamics, and in some cases we were studying bulks, volumes of fluid. In other cases, we were looking at very thin films of materials. It turned out quite unexpectedly that those same kind of techniques that we were using for our basic scientific research could be very valuable for this kind of thin film metrology that's needed for silicon device manufacture. And so that's a good example of something that was, you know, developed really primarily with the science in mind, but the techniques became so well developed and so routine that they could be adapted for use in applications that we never anticipated at the beginning. And so, you know, having a good sense of what's going on in industry, what the problems are, can help you to kind of connect your scientific research to other kind of application possibilities that might be very valuable to an industry or to society in general. So it's hard to know exactly. And we aren't strictly tied to those, you know, our envisioned applications when we're carrying out, you know, a scientific research effort. We have those in mind, but we are also very cognizant of the fact that, you know, whatever we're working on now could go in completely unexpected directions, and kind of keeping your eyes open to, you know, activities across, you know, all fields of engineering can be very valuable in seeing those connections.
What else are you interested in for the future of technology?
I think, new materials are going to enable new capabilities in electronics and photonics. And I think, that's where our research is really focused. I mean, being able to manipulate electrons and photons on very small scales and to combine those functionalities into a single chip. I mean, I think that these kind of new enabling technologies are going to enable, just enormous advances in computing capability. And that will just have very, very, very wide-ranging impact on all sorts of information technologies.
How do you think your inventions will impact society?
Well, you always hope that it's going to have a big impact, you know. I guess I have three things that I feel have had some level of impact, and the fourth one is probably something that will emerge from this flexible electronic stuff, although it's too early to say exactly where it's going to go. So, the first one would be these laser-based approaches for making, manufacturing of silicon-based electronic devices just more efficient and more cost-effective. And so that's one example. When I was at Bell Labs, we got interested in fiber optic devices of different types. And the main function of an optical fiber in a communication network is to just transmit information as encoded in very short pulses of light, streams of such pulses, from point A to point B. I mean, the optical fiber is purely passive element for just transmitting that information. And we got interested in whether the fiber could be used as an active or reconfigurable or tunable component of a fiber optic communication network rather than just that passive element. Could you embed sort of active functionality in the thing in a way that could make the operation of the network more efficient or more cost effective or higher speed in its operation? And so we developed a couple of different kind of active fiber devices that involved very tiny actuators that we could print right on the outside of a fiber. So in a very simple sense, we could form simple circuits on the outside of an optical fiber, which is basically a thread of glass that has a diameter, comparable to a human hair. You could actually form circuits on those fibers, and then you wire them up, you apply a voltage or flow a current, and you could change in real time the way that those pulses of light transmitted through that section of fiber, which had that embedded circuitry. So we developed some devices that are used for what's called tunable dispersion compensating elements to control the pulse widths of those short packets of information going down the fiber. That was really an enabling, one of several enabling technologies for 40 gigabit per second optical, data network. So just enabling very, very, very high speed, internet access and so on. So that was another example of something that came out of our research labs that turned out to be valuable. The third one was a project that we were working on at Bell Laboratories on flexible plastic electronic devices. We actually built some of these paper-like displays that I mentioned before. So we built the very first prototype display of that type, flexible paper-like display. And although it's taken a little bit longer than I thought it would, it looks like those type of displays are going to make it, in terms of a consumer electronic device that you'd be able to buy at Circuit City or Best Buy. And it will be present in its first embodiment as a display for a PDA, a personal digital assistant, like a Palm Pilot. But the Palm Pilot won't look like a conventional Palm Pilot. It'll look like a pen, like a writing pen, mm-hmm. in which you have the display roll up into the pen when you're not using it, and you kind of unfurl it when you want to use your PDA. And it looks like that's going to happen. Philips is commercializing that technology, which we licensed to E Inc., which is a small company in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and then they in turn licensed it to Philips. So some of that technology that we worked at Bell Labs looks like it's going to make it, you know, in terms of a product. And although I'm not directly involved in those efforts anymore, it's very satisfying to see it go all of that distance. So you know, it's always hard to know, you know, whether what you're working on is going to really make it. And most things that you work on don't make it for one reason or another. It's too expensive, or it's not reliable enough, or the performance is not good enough. But in those three examples, it's pretty satisfying to see these things actually, you know, get into a form that's really useful in a practical sense.
Where do you see Beckman's innovations in 5 years or 10 years?
Well, Beckman is a really interesting, facility here on campus. It reminds me a lot of Bell Laboratories in terms of its interdisciplinary reach and its, focus on technologies, you know, science at the core, but, you know, widgets and new inventions and things like that. And actually, the new director of the Beckman Institute, I think he started in 2002, was my first boss at Bell Labs. So I'm, you know, now in the Beckman, and he's my boss again at some level. So he's the guy who hired me to Bell Labs, and, you know, he's one of the guys who really sold me on Illinois as a place to do research. And, you know, everything he told me turned out to be true. It's just been great. So about half of my labs and half of my students are in the Beckman Institute, and he's really configured it as a mini Bell Labs. And, you know, it's one of the things I really like about the campus here.
Okay. And last of all, what do you see your research achieving in the future?
Well, again, I think ultimately, you know, we either want to do, you know, novel and interesting fundamental science, and, you know, when we can, try to convert that science into some, you know, engineering development that leads to products and so on. So I think if we can continue to do that, then I, you know, I'd be very satisfied as a researcher if we, you know, continue that direction.
All right. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks a lot.